Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
News from the Inspectors General first here today. The New York Federal Reserve is refusing to tell investigators how many billions of dollars it shipped to Iraq during those early days of the U.S. invasion there. That's according to the Special Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction. The Fed's lack of disclosure is making it difficult for the Inspector General to follow the paper trail of billions of dollars that went missing in the rush to finance the Iraqi occupation and to determine how much of the money was stolen. The New York Fed won't release details, the Inspector General said, because the money initially came from an account at the Fed held through the Oil for Food program without authorization from the account holder, which just happens to be the Iraqi government itself. The Inspector General's office was told it can't receive information about the account. Critics of the Iraqi government believe highly placed officials in that country are among the people who made off with the money in the first place, and some think that will make it highly unlikely the Iraqis will agree to reveal any information about the dollar amount. It's just dollars. My frustration is not with the New York Fed, it is with the Iraqis, says the Special Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction. They haven't been sufficiently responsive, but they've been remarkably reconstructed. Ladies and gentlemen, clean, safe, so safe. The Tokyo Electric Power Company said now that the filtration system it struggled to put into operation at the damaged Fuk nuclear plant had broken down after just 5 hours, a disappointing setback in its efforts to cool the reactors. The company said the system was shut down because of readings that indicate one of the filters had filled up with radioactive cesium, supposed to have lasted several weeks, suggests the presence of far greater radiation than anticipated. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a special edition of Le Show. A couple of weeks ago, just before I left New Orleans for London, it was a Thursday night, and I walked around the neighborhood and was able to see live performances by three of my favorite piano players in New Orleans. Just one, two, right, just lined up for me, as if at a festival, except it was just an ordinary Thursday night. Well, I'm going to try to recreate a bit of that experience for you today. Live performances by a couple of my favorite New Orleans piano players, as well as some conversation from previous broadcasts. And first up is the great John Cleary.
Thank you for having me. Thanks.
You don't talk like a New Orleanian. This suggests you come from somewhere else.
Either that or I practice an English accent every day.
You sit and watch Masterpiece Theatre when you should be woodshedding.
No, I'm from London originally, but I moved here as a teenager 30 years ago.
Whew.
Which is mind-boggling when I say it. It doesn't seem like 30 years, but I came here in 1980. Just in time to catch the kind of the last of all the great R&B guys that were still on good form.
You know, saw Professor Longhair?
No. Unfortunately, I got here just too late for Fess. That was a real shame. But I got to see James Booker, who played in my local bar every Tuesday night, and Roosevelt Sykes would hang out in the bar and play in the daytime. The Honey Dripper. And the night I arrived, Earl King was playing.
Oh.
So I got to see these guys who, for me, were just names on the back of very hard-to-find records, you know. And I was very lucky. I ended up actually getting to becoming friends with a bunch of them, and they would call me and ask me to come play. So I got to being in awe of them and from a great distance all the way over in Europe. And then the next minute I'm in New Orleans, and I'm actually getting hired to do gigs with them.
And this suggests that you didn't experience any of the you're an outsider, you don't belong here, get out of here, that people might think would happen.
No, a lot of people ask me about that. And the best musicians, the guys that were really good at it, didn't care. Well, the people here are very welcoming from the outside. On the condition, as long as you can play. I mean, if you can play, that's the only prerequisite. Mm-hmm. You know, so everything else doesn't really matter.
So you must have been in some kind of hog heaven as this all came down.
Well, I was, and I think I probably got a lot of the gigs by default, really, because it was amazing to me that at the time I arrived there would seem to be very few people who were actually playing what I understood to be New Orleans piano. The greatest one of all, James Booker, was working regularly, but he was ignored pretty much. You know, he played at my local bar every Tuesday night.
The Maple Leaf?
At the Maple Leaf, yeah. And the place would often be empty.
Well, you hear those recordings of him at the Maple Leaf, and then you hear...
Yeah, I was there on those nights when they... they recorded every week. I was there all the time. I had a job painting the bar, and often I would come in... Actually, that's how I got my first piano gig, because I was a guitar player. I played guitar as a kid. And that was my main instrument. When I arrived in New Orleans, I got a job painting the bar. And on Tuesday... The deal was we worked whatever hours we wanted. This was the job offer. You can work whatever hours you want. You get free drink while you work.
So stretch it out.
Yeah, half price drink any other time. You get to see all the bands for free. It was great, man. I was 17 years old in heaven. Mm. But we'd start work very late, very hungover, and be getting through long after dark. We're paint outside on the ladders painting in the dark, two crazy 17-year-olds. And as Booker was getting ready to start playing, I would usually be scrubbing, trying to get all the green paint off myself and cleaning brushes and stuff. And on those occasions where he didn't show up or showed up late, they would ask me to play just to keep those few customers who actually paid money to come and see him, to keep them in the bar.
So they'd buy some drinks. Yeah.
So they get me to play, and I play whatever songs I knew until Booker showed up. That's how I started doing piano gigs.
Wow.
But he was the main guy, really. Dr. John was one of my legends, one of my heroes. You know, he didn't live in New Orleans at that time, so it was unusual to see him. Mm-hmm. And there were other guys who were around, but not... I mean, I really came here thinking that there was a town full of piano players. You know, New Orleans has that reputation.
Yeah.
So when I did get to play with guys like Earl King and Cato and Jesse Hill and Snooks and people like that, I think I got asked back because I actually knew a lot of the material, because I'd grown up listening to that stuff.
This had been what you'd been listening to back in England?
Yeah, yeah. I had an uncle who used to live in New Orleans, and he had mountains of 45s. And every night up at his house was an education. It would start with a Clifton Chenier 45, and then in the process of trying to find a particular song, he'd unearth all these other dusty old 45s, and it would be Clarence Henry and Jiving Jean and the Jokers, Professor Longhair, Huey Smith, and it was great. Yeah, so I got a thorough grounding in New Orleans R&B.
And then would you go home and try to play what you just heard? Or
Yeah, I remember trying to play Big Chief, it took me two hands, and I was playing in the wrong key. It would be like... And now it's, you know... And then that riff would... A lot of this stuff would take two hands. This riff... That's the classic New Orleans...
Turnaround.
Lick.
Yeah.
I started messing with that stuff when I was about 11 or 12.
And then when you came here, did anybody say, young fella, here's how you do that, or you just picked that up as you went along?
I just picked it up. There's no laws, there's no rules. And really, in all the, you know, through the history of New Orleans, the guys that made a difference are the ones that threw the rule books out the window. I mean, that riff I was just playing, that Professor Longhair thing. There was nothing like that before he did it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's from New Orleans. There's no doubt that what he plays is from New Orleans. But that didn't really have any precedent. And I think, you know, when you look at the great moments in New Orleans musical history, whether it's Jelly Roll Morton right up to the Meters, they play the way they play by virtue of being here from New Orleans. But it's not a matter of adhering to an academic set of rules that this is how you do it.
It's how you feel it.
Yeah, it's how you feel it. Yeah. And you kind of, I think to play New Orleans music right, you have to come and live in New Orleans. That's the difference. And you soak it up as a process of osmosis. You just breathe. You go to your second line at funerals. You go jump in and step at a Mardi Gras parade, and it just gradually soaks in.
That's a high price to pay, isn't it? To be able to play this music, to have to live here.
It's tough
work. Why don't you show us what you've soaked up for a moment here?
Well, I play my favorite thing, one that I play on at all the gigs, and it's a Professor Longhair tune, and I heard the Fess version, and I heard a solo version that Dr. John did of it when I was a kid first checking this stuff out. And there was one particular riff that just took my breath away, which is, and I'll show you where it comes in. So it's Tipitina. And Tipitina was a tune that was a hit for Fess, and it was one of a long line of tunes that used the same basic chord changes the fundamental root of which, way back in the day, they used to call the Junkers Blues.
Mm.
And they used the same chord progression with various sets of lyrics and various arrangements, but always fundamentally the same basic 1-4-5 changes. And at one point it was called Ti-na-na. At one point they used it for Lordy Miss Claudie, for Stagger Lee, the Fat Man, Champion Jack Dupree way back with Junkers Blues, and even way before that. But it was a very basic fundamental blues. I think early on anybody could pretty much play it. I guess in the early version, early incarnation, it would have been... pretty basic stuff. And then when Fess got hold of it, it turned into more of although actually this isn't really true to the Professor Longhead. I think this is more like what Dr. John did with it. I like to make it even funky like this.
No syncopation there.
Syncopation is the root of all that stuff. You've got to break music down into the rhythm and the harmony. And New Orleans is part of that word that includes Cuba, Haiti, where the way you break up four beats of a bar is turned into advanced mathematics. You know, and then in New Orleans... the way they approach harmony and the chord progressions and melody, that's very important too. So it's a marriage of those two things. So you have to get those ingredients right. Yeah.
No kidding.
And it doesn't have to be sophisticated necessarily. You can have the grittiest, funkiest, lowest common denominator. But a lot of the great musicians in New Orleans can do that. And then at the drop of a hat, if it's necessary, it can suddenly blossom into this gorgeous, extravagant, delicate,
Baroque structure.
Yeah. Masterpiece. Something beautiful, complicated, sophisticated. You know.
Where the hell's the one? Where the hell's the root? Leaving the audience, if they're drunk enough, in the dust of... And then you surprise them by saying, here it is. It was here all along. I think a lot of people first got to know you around the country when you opened for Bonnie Raitt and toured with Bonnie Raitt for a good few years. What is that, 3-4 years?
I was playing with Bonnie for 10 years.
Good Lord.
I know. It flew by really quickly.
Yeah.
Well, before that, I was playing with Taj Mahal. I mean, I'd played in New Orleans for years, in little clubs in New Orleans, and you can make a living in New Orleans playing without going anywhere else. And you can, a lot of people are quite happy doing that. A lot of people don't want to tour necessarily, and you can make, have a lifelong career here, and no one ever hears of you outside of Orleans Parish.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a job playing piano for Taj Mahal, who is one of my idols.
Mm-hmm.
He lives out in California. And so that was my first experience, really, of touring outside of New Orleans. And that lasted for a few years, and from that, I got acquainted with Bonnie, and then Bonnie asked me to come and play with her. So it was very interesting. You know, it's such a... Well, fundamentally, the music that is no different. What I do as a piano player is not very different, really. And that was, I think, why she hired me, because she liked that style, obviously. But the... you know, the level of professionalism and the actual business side of it was quite eye-opening for me, from being, coming from down here. coming from New Orleans, just the fact there was a business side.
Yeah. What do you mean?
So that was really good. Good experience, yeah.
She allowed you to open for her, so the audience didn't see you just as a sideman, right? They saw you
She was always very generous in letting me take solos and join her on the vocals, and she would perform songs that I'd written. And then I get to stretch out and play some mandolin and some guitar and some percussion and do some other bits and pieces too. So, yeah, it was great. Yeah.
How long have you been writing songs?
I've been writing songs... for as long as I've been playing, really, I guess, yeah. Sort of making things up and, you know. When you're playing the kind of music I play, you write every time you sit down and play. There are some aspects of music and some musicians who will perform set pieces where essentially note for note is identical from one night to the next. That doesn't really work that way down here. And so you compose and you improvise. So it's all spontaneous. So every time you play, you're composing, really, and writing.
Some would say that's a lot of pressure.
For me, there would be much more pressure to try and do the same thing twice. I wasn't a classically trained musician. I was taught by family members who were musicians. So I learned to play by ear, by trial and error, by listening to records, by sneaking out and seeing bands whenever I was able to.
And when did you first start singing?
I've always sung, as long as I can remember. When I was a little kid, my parents would have parties and there'd be musicians playing, and I would go and sneak, you know, long past my bedtime, and I would be, I'd get up and go and stand by the door and listen, and they'd find out sooner or later that I was there, and I was allowed to stay up on the condition that I sang. And Jesse James was the song I sang. That was the only song I knew. So I'd sing Jesse James, and they'd let me stay up and listen to the music. So I've been singing since I was about five, yeah.
Could I ask you to do a song with a vocal part in it?
Sure. Let me play. I'm going to play this song that I used to play with Snooks Eaglin, just because it's the first thing that pops into my head. And this is a Benny King tune from back in the day. Every time I kiss somebody new, make believe I'm kissing you. I can't keep my aching heart. Now I know we're still apart, baby. Each night seems like a thousand years old. I can't lose these young boy blues. Make me cry when I hear your name. And if I cry, you know I feel so ashamed. And I can't get my aching heart. My heart knows we're still apart, baby, now. Each night is like a thousand years old. I can't lose these young boy blues. Don't know where to go. Don't know what to do now, baby. Well, I'm so lost and worried since you went away. Every time I kiss somebody new, make believe I'm kissing you, and I can't get my aching heart. My heart, no, it's still apart, baby. Each night feel like a thousand years old. I can't lose these young boy blues. Each night feel like a thousand years old. Young boy blues, no, no, baby.
John Cleary, and we'll have more with John. But Henry Butler is another one of my favorite New Orleans piano players, currently residing in Brooklyn, New York. But a few years back, we had an interview, conversation, a live session in New Orleans. Here's a bit of that now. Here's Henry.
One of the things that appears on the new record is a piece entitled Bourbon Street Blues. It's actually in the stride style, and we'll play that one.
Great. Bourbon Henry Street. Butler.
Thank you. Thank you.
did you come to do this for a living?
Oh, you mean play piano for a living?
Yeah.
Or
yeah. How did you get
play
yeah.
music? Well, it started at a state school for the blind in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where I was a student from first grade through my last year of high school. I was volunteered as a musician by a lady by the name of J.S. Catley, and she was too big for me to argue with.
You were volunteered for it.
That's right. Yeah. You know, in the Army sense of the word.
Exactly.
And so, actually, it took took quite a while for me to really take to that, because, of course, back in those days, you were considered something other than normal if you took piano lessons.
Do I read your meaning correctly?
I think you do.
Okay.
I think, you know, and unfortunately, those days did put those labels on you, especially kids, little boys. And little boys can be quite cruel toward each other.
No kidding.
Oh, yes.
That's always been something that amazed me. In this country, there's this myth of childhood innocence. And, you know, you just wonder, didn't these people pay attention when they were children?
Innocence?
Yeah.
that's very funny.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I really started to show some potential, all that sort of disappeared. I remember the first arrangement that I did was for two trombones and piano, and all the kids said, "Wow, man, that was great. They wanted to start taking piano lessons. They wanted all the glory, but they didn't want to do the work.
I know the feeling.
Oh, yes.
I took piano lessons, but I didn't want to do the work. That's why I'm sitting here and you're sitting there.
Well, actually, you've done a lot of good stuff, man.
Well, I wasn't fishing for that. No,
well,
I'm just saying.
Right.
I had a teacher who just couldn't accept the fact that I thought an hour a day was as much as anyone needed to practice. And she was right, and I was wrong.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, I started out doing an hour a day, and the next thing I knew, it was like five and six and seven. That was pretty tough.
How old were you when you did your first gig as a piano player?
I was 14 when I started accepting money. I guess at that point I became a professional. I was 14. I was in the ninth grade. And we had in that group four or five horns, I think, and an occasional bass player. And that's where I learned how to use my left hand.
When he didn't show up, you mean?
No, that's right. Yeah. Well, many times we didn't have one to show up, so there was one or two people that we knew we could use from time to time, but they were always busy because they were pretty good. And so I learned to use my left hand, and I just basically pounded it out at that time. And right now, my left hand serves me fairly well.
Exceedingly well.
Thank you.
You do stuff, among other things, you do stuff in unison with two hands that is trickier and more complex than most people can pull off with one.
Well, I teach my students that they should not do anything in their right hand that the left hand can't do.
Hmm.
And I kind of follow that for myself as well. Whether I'm playing as a sideman or backing up someone, or whether I'm doing it as a soloist, I think it's very important to be able to use the whole piano, and not only to play parallel octaves in both hands, but to be able to do things in contrary motion. That means going in different directions at the same time.
Mm. Play for us, if you would, something else from your album or from another album?
Certainly. I'd like to do this next piece. It actually has become one of my signature tunes. It's a piece that I did when I was on Windham Hill, and it's the title track of that record. It's entitled Orleans Inspiration.
Thank you. What is it about New Orleans that keeps piano music alive, where piano traditions don't seem to be flourishing elsewhere in the country?
I think it's the rhythm. I think it's the rhythm, and I also think that there's more than just piano music that's alive here. You have a sort of a revival of the brass bands, mm-hmm. and these guys are the straight from the street, mm-hmm. and it's great. You know, it's you have the street rhythms, and they're really drawing, whether they know it or not, from sort of the rhythms of the Place du Congo festivals. And they're also drawing from the traditional jazz repertoire and the gospel repertoire. Basically the same kind of things that the brass bands of the back around the turn of the century, the same devices, the same tools that they used. They're just updated today. Mm. They're using, in many cases, popular music of the day with the same traditional jazz rhythms, with the same with the traditional jazz rhythms integrated with funk sometimes, and they've found a way to blend them very well. I mean, they've done it very well.
Yeah, it's just amazing that I've said this before, but that they the guitar has taken over everywhere else except here, where it's, you know, there's still room for horns and piano and all sorts of other things.
Well, New Orleans has its own subculture, and in most cases, when a city has its own subculture, it's hard for other things to get in. It's just like the cuisine here. It's like the food cuisine. Most of the restaurants in New Orleans serves some kind of Creole or Cajun cuisine. It's modified in this way or that way. But it doesn't matter what, even when you go to some of the Japanese restaurants. It's amazing.
Creole Japanese?
Yeah, it's amazing. Obviously, they don't say that, but it's probably a little more spicy than some of the Japanese restaurants that you might find in Houston or even Los Angeles. Mm. It's hard for other ethnic restaurants to get in here. I mean, there are a few Vietnamese places, a few Thai, Chinese, that kind of thing. Same thing is happening with music. You get a lot of straight-ahead jazz in because there are a lot of straight-ahead jazz musicians in New Orleans. But there are not that many straight-ahead jazz outlets for playing that music here. And unfortunately, New Orleans misses, a lot of the shows, say, put on by straight-ahead musicians don't come into New Orleans, except during the time of, say, the Jazz Festival. And occasionally the House of Blues may bring somebody in. But by and large, and mostly you get street music with the New Orleans influence. New Orleans funk and blues with New Orleans influence.
Mm. It's a pretty good diet, though.
Oh, look, you know, I'm not complaining.
Yeah.
And, of course, I have the good fortune of living in cities that where jazz flourished, so I may not need it as much as some of the other people here might. Plus, I can practice.
Great. Do one more for us, if you would.
Oh, certainly. This piece is entitled Got My Eyes on You.
You got a great big smile. You got a great Henry Butler from New Orleans.
This is Le Show. Our guest is John Cleary. And I have to ask you a rude question. I'm used to, because of family and other, and just following, you know, from Tom Jones onward, the fact that Welsh people can sing soulfully and occasionally Scott. How does normally you don't connect the words English and soulful.
Well, you know.
Or am I wrong?
Well, my family's all Irish back in the day.
So
maybe it was the Celtic blood.
Yeah,
that's part
it's the
of
Celtic
it.
Thing, of course.
So, but, you know, that whole soulful thing, it doesn't matter where you're from, really. You can find soulful music anywhere you go if you look hard enough for it. And I was lucky because I grew up in a family of soulful musicians.
Now, you I know from talking to you and hanging with you that you're a total Johnny Guitar Watson maniac.
Yeah, I love Johnny Watson.
But was that something that you were into at the time? Or who was the reigning funk kings of England when you were there? Or were there such a thing?
Well, I left England when I was...
Was it Hot Chocolate?
17. God. I mean... you know, I was too young, really, for the kind of to be into the soul thing when it was happening.
Mm.
You know, 1973 was when a lot of great soul records were made, and I was 11 years old.
Ah, yeah.
So the stuff that my peers were listening to was whatever was on Top of the Pops that week, which was usually Gary Glitter's glam rock. You know, and then the Sex Pistols came along, and that was pretty mind blowing. But when you go, so with the gigs I could go and see as a kid were punk rock gigs. We'd see all the punk bands. But at that time in England, every time when you went to a punk gig, there was always a reggae band on the bill. There was always would be a punk band and a reggae band. So I got to see all these great Jamaican bands. So that was our kind of soul music in England, if you like. The stuff they had access to was Jamaican music.
Mm, well, that's not bad.
Yeah, so I got to see, man, in the late 70s, got to see great, the Mighty Diamonds, Culture, Gladiators. Steel Pulse, Asrad, Mutumbi, all the English reggae stuff, and Dennis Bavel. So that was kind of the soul stuff. And then, I was listening to New Orleans R&B, and that really was the stuff that got me. I loved just that. That was the stuff that really pressed all my buttons. And then after moving here and learning a little bit more and getting to play with guys like Walter Washington and Johnny Adams and playing in a lot of the little black bars in New Orleans and hearing and just, you know, being a funk detective and checking out the jukeboxes, and all of a sudden it's like, wow, Johnny Taylor, Little Milton, Tyrone Davis. That stuff really, that was the stuff that really got me.
Tyrone, Can I Change My Mind, Davis?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so that then really, that got me pretty hard. The real good old Southern soul music.
So then you form a band at one point. And I'd been aware of you as a player and as a performer, but when this band broke on the New Orleans scene, I think it knocked a lot of people for a major loop. It was the funkiest stuff that I'd heard since the original Meters had fled the scene. How'd you put that band together? How'd you come up with the name? And it was also, New Orleans is a great music town. It's not always a great record making town. That was that John Cleary and the Absolute Monster Gentleman record is a great sounding record. It's a real record.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I'd, the first time I put a band together in New Orleans was after having lived here for a couple of years. I lived here for 2 years and just looked and learnt and listened a lot. And then I went back to England. I had to leave and go back. And that was when I first got my experience at hiring musicians, hustling gigs, plugging in PA systems, getting paid at the end of the night.
The glamour stuff.
Yeah, and all that. So, yeah, the nuts and bolts of the trade, really, just being a working musician. So I felt, having done that, when I then came back to New Orleans, that I was then equipped to kind of do it and do it right. Prior to that, I did didn't. I spent most of my time just listening, soaking it up, and shedding. Then you had a piano in the house. I moved to play for hours every day. And then the first band I put together, you know, I was quite cheeky. I would call the best players in town. So the very first band I put together in New Orleans had George Porter on bass, Walter Washington on guitar, Kenneth Blevins on drums. They made great. And I would always hire the baddest musicians. Because that's what you do if you want to sound good, surround yourself with the best cats. So I got to play with guys from the Meters, from George Porter, and then Fats Domino's rhythm section. I'd hire them for little. And these are just little gigs, and as I said, it was a bit cheeky of me, but I realized, man, they're all musicians. They all need gigs. They're happy, and if you can, the first gig, if they dig it, then they don't mind you calling them back, and they always dug it because I was playing the old stuff that they grew up with. So I was hiring guys that were sort of 20 or 30 years older than me, but I was calling out songs that they recognized from when they were teenagers, because that's kind of what I grew up listening to. And so I got spoiled, all these great musicians. But I found that as much as I loved doing the old obscure New Orleans standards and Little Willie John tunes, these songs that I could call without having to have rehearsals, knowing that these guys would know him, mm-hmm. and be able to jump in and fall straight in. At the same time, I was writing songs and I wasn't able to play them because I needed to have guys that would learn these songs. They'd never heard those before, so it was a different kettle of fish altogether. So around that time, I put together a band with some musicians that I'd become friends with who were in a gospel band called the Friendly Travelers. And I sort of broke with the tradition, and for Jazz Fest one year, instead of using the old cats, the session players, I used these guys whose experience was really playing coffee bars and playing in church, not playing festivals and nightclubs and all that. But they were great players and nice guys, and they were agreeable to getting together and working, rehearsing and learning the stuff. So that's the band I put together. And we needed a name for the band, and around that time, Johnny Guitar Watson came out of retirement and came to perform in New Orleans. And it's hard to come up with a good name for a band, and ask all your friends for ideas, and everyone comes up with stupid ideas or double entendre. It soon degenerates into the silliest name anyone could think of. But Johnny Watson introduced one of the musicians on the band as an absolute monster gentleman, and I thought, that's it. That's the name, the absolute monster gentleman.
So it came from Johnny Guitar Watson?
Johnny Guitar Watson, yeah, he deserves the credit. Mm. So that was the band, John Cleary and the Absolute Monster Gentleman.
Yeah. And that band was together it broke up?
For about 10 years, and it's not really broken up. We'll still be doing gigs here and there.
Mm.
But the challenge is to try and have as broad a musical diet as possible, and so it's fun to have the luxury here of playing with as many great musicians as you can. And so recently I've been doing trio gigs with just a different timbre, a different texture of music. So it's more acoustic piano with upright bass, as opposed to the Monster Gents thing, which is kind of electric R&B and funk.
And you've also been doing solo gigs, to my great delight, as well.
I've been doing some solo gigs. I used to do a lot of solo gigs back in the day, but I'm kind of digging it now, yeah.
It's I bow to no one in my admiration for that band, but, I'll always come hear you play solo. Could you do something else for us right now?
Sure. I'll play you a blues. This is Port Street Blues. I used to live on Port Street, and this funky old falling down house about 100 yards from the Mississippi River in the old part of town of New Orleans. And this one, I lived there for about 15 years in this beautiful old place, man. It was great. And so when I'd be away on tour, I'd always get homesick for New Orleans. And this is all about missing New Orleans, and it's called Port Street Blues. Camelback Riverside Shack, a Creel shotgun, little yard out back, cool breezing, wriggling, blowing through my banana trees, yawning, rusty freight ship drifting in from an ocean far away. Cast long shadows on my back porch,
at the sad time of day. I'm just trying to tell y'all about a feeling I can't lose. I'm a long way from home, yeah, and I got the Port Street blues. There's a beat up piano that cha-cha's out of tune. And in the corner there's a messed up jukebox, pick up all the room. You can't sit down for stacks and stacks of scratched up 45s, and them cobwebs hang from the ceiling fan, blow the smoke back in your eyes. But the door is always open if you somewhere close by around, and the walls always shaking to a sweet soulful sound. I'm just trying to tell you all about them, a feeling I can't lose. I'm a long way from home, oh, not long, I got the Pawn Street blues. Down on Port Street, I'm gonna kick out both my shoes. Pull me out the first one, y'all. Oh, slap on my grocery grooves. I'm calling on a friend of Travis. I wanna hear the wolfman howl the blues. I'm hanging with the funk captain, y'all. Back on Port Street, FHQ. Port Street. You know that's the only place I find. Oh, oh, yeah, I can rest my worried heart. I can rest my worried heart. I can rest my worried heart. Yeah, and pacify my mind. Ooh.
You buttoned yourself. Thank sure. you so much for sharing your time and your talent with us.
Thank you for having me. It's great. Great to be able to do this. Let me see. This is something I've just been messing with. So, little kind of the Caribbean aspect of New Orleans.
My thanks to John Cleary for being my extra special guest today on the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz. On the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available on your smartphone through Stitcher.com, available as a free download for members at Audible.com, and available as a free podcast at KCRW.com. And it would be just like having just enough rodent droppings that you could count at the state capitol cafeteria in Pennsylvania if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Already, thank you very much, A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Thanks again, indeed, as well, to John Fishback at Piety Street Studios here in New Orleans, Louisiana. Email address of this broadcast and the playlist of the recorded music heard hereon can always be found at harryshearer.com. And the show is on Twitter, at LeTwits. The show comes to you from KCRW Santa Monica, the home of the homeless, and of master criminal Whitey Bulger. And the Twitter address has changed, of course, since that was recorded. You can find us on Twitter at The Harry Shearer. And you can find Whitey Bulger everywhere, but in the home of the homeless.